And I think this idea of redefining paradigms over how we can look into persuasion, our next speaker is going to look at from a leadership perspective. He's written over 6 books on the concepts around leadership. He's also a consultant in this area. The Secret Language of Leadership was one of his books. I highly recommend it. Please welcome Steve, our next speaker.
It's October 3rd, 2000. We are in the midst of the US presidential election, George W. Bush against Al Gore. And in fact, we're on the eve of the first presidential debate. And if elections were determined on a rational basis, Al Gore would be winning this election by a mile. If you think back to that time, the economy was strong, jobs, housing, growth. Al Gore should be winning this election. He had been involved in some of the foreign policy triumphs, and he had 24 years of national and international experience, and he was facing a candidate who had neither. So if elections were determined on a rational basis, he should be winning by a mile. But he wasn't. In fact, the polls were very tight, because Al Gore had not been able to connect to the electorate, and he knew with this television debate tonight that he could connect with 90 million people, and he knew that in order to do that, he needed to tell stories. So he comes to this debate armed with stories, and he tells those stories. Unfortunately, they're the wrong stories. They have the opposite effect of what he hoped to achieve, and at least according to the Supreme Court, he went on to lose the election. Fast forward to 2006, and what do we see? Al Gore is now wandering around the world, drawing huge, enthusiastic audiences for a very difficult change message. And he has won an Emmy, he's won an Oscar, he's even won the Nobel Peace Prize. He is now rock star popular. He can fill a stadium deep in Republican country faster than Elton John. What's going on? In 2000, Al Gore did not know how to tell a story. In 2006, he'd learned how to do that and communicate a strange, difficult message to an audience and inspire them to want to change. Leadership is not just about getting people to change, it's about getting people to want to change, to inspire people to become champions of the change, and that's what I'll be talking about. How do you do that? The central challenge of leadership. I got into this subject in February 1996 when I was working in the World Bank in Washington, D.C., this big international organization that has billions of dollars to help eliminate poverty around the world. And how did I get there? Well, I was born in Sydney, Australia. I grew up there. I studied at Sydney University. I studied psychology. I studied law. Worked in a big law firm. And then I went to Oxford University in England, studied some more law. And I came to Washington, D.C., and I joined the World Bank. And I was a very left-brain, analytic kind of person. Clear, crisp, succinct, bottom line. That was me. And as you may know, big organizations just love that kind of person. So I started climbing up the managerial ladder in the World Bank. And by February 1996, I was actually the director of the Africa region. The Africa region handles about a third of the lending operations in this big international organization, so I'm beginning to think, hey, this is a pretty important kind of position. But then as things happen in big organizations, the scene abruptly changed. The president of the World Bank suddenly died, and my boss unexpectedly retired. And somebody else was appointed to my position. See, things not going too well for me now at the World Bank. So I went to see the top management and asked them, do you have anything in mind for me? Not really. It happens if we go back. But I pressed them quite a bit. I mentioned that they said, okay, Steve, why don't you go and look into information? Information, February 1996, in the World Bank, had the status of like the garage or the cafeteria. So I was not exactly being offered a promotion here. I was being sent to Siberia. But I was kind of interested in information. I thought we were drowning in information all over the place, couldn't find anything, wasting a ton of money. Obviously, we had to clean this mess up. But if we cleaned it up, we would still be the same kind of slow-moving, etc. Lending organization. And people all around the world were asking, do we actually need a slow-moving public sector lending organization? So simply making it more efficient wasn't going to solve our problem. We had to find a different role in life. So I had another thought. Why don't we share our knowledge? In fact, the World Bank had tremendous expertise in all sorts of different areas, but very difficult to get access to it. So I said, why don't we reverse that? Why don't we make it very easy for anyone to find out what we know? Then we could actually be a pretty interesting organization, even an exciting organization. Let's become a knowledge-sharing organization. I thought it was a pretty good idea, so I set out to persuade my colleagues, let's become a knowledge-sharing organization. And my colleagues had a very clear answer for me. They said, Steve, this is the world. Bang! Bang! We lend money! Here's your salary! Stick around the world, we're a lending organization! Didn't seem to work too well. I gave them reasons, they didn't listen, I showed them slides, they sort of dazed. And I was a desperate man, and until one day stumbled on something else. We're talking about the future of the World Bank, and what's it going to be like? Well, I said, it's going to be like today. Let me tell you about something that happened just a few months ago. In June 1995, this is still in early 1996, in June 1995, a health worker in a little village in Zambia, in Africa, logged onto the website for the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, and got the answer to a question on how to treat malaria. Now, that was June 1995, not June 2015. It wasn't the capital of Zambia, a little place 600 kilometers away. And this is not a rich country, this is Zambia, one of the poorest countries in the world. But you know the most important part of this picture for us in the World Bank? The World Bank is not in this picture. The World Bank does not have its knowledge organized to share with all the millions of people who make decisions about poverty. But just imagine if it was. Just imagine if we got organized. Think what an organization we could have found. Yeah, that started resonating. First with staff, and then managers, and then the president of the World Bank heard about it, and he said, right, let's do it. He went to the annual meeting of the World Bank, October 1, 1996. Huge public occasion. 170 finance ministers, all their entourages, massive public occasion. He announced, we are going to do this. We are going to share our knowledge with the world. We are going to become the knowledge bank. And when the people who sent me to Siberia just a few months before this announcement heard this announcement, they were horrified because this was the worst case scenario. This was the very nightmare they were worried about because now the man from Siberia was back. And not only back, but it somehow managed to co-opt the whole group of staff, the managers, and now even the president had issued this crazy idea of becoming the knowledge sharing organization. So this wasn't the end of the war, this was just the beginning of the war. This is when we started to use real bullets instead of rubber bullets, because now there was a risk this thing might actually happen. So the next 4 years were a whole set of battles and struggles as to whether we were going to implement this strange new idea, and if so, what it would look like. And I found what I didn't tell. Story like that, Zambia's story, everything would be turmoil and confusion. And when it did tell a story like that, suddenly we'd be moving forward into the future. So not being totally unobservant, I kept telling stories. And by the year 2000, the World Bank was being benchmarked as a world leader in knowledge management. And people were pressing me, well, what were you doing with an organization? Because in every other area, this organization moves like a snail. And in this area, it's racing ahead as fast as any organization in the world. And I had to confess that I was using the ancient art of storytelling for some very modern purposes to inspire them to embrace a strange new idea. I left the World Bank in 2000 and since been going around the world coaching organizations on how to use the power of story. And what I discovered in this work is that most stories do not work. Most stories, in fact, often have the opposite effect of what a leader intends. In order to use stories effectively, you have to understand a pattern of an effective leadership story. And there are a number of elements. The foremost important ones are the following. First of all, it's a true story. It actually happened. Go to Zambia, check it out. It actually happened. It's the truth of the story that can awake people out of their complacency. And when I say true, I don't just mean factually accurate. As far as it goes, I mean a story that's authentically true. When people go and check it out, then believe me, they will. They say, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. I mean, here's an example of a story that's factually accurate as far as it goes, but it has a little problem. 700 happy passengers reached New York after the Titanic's maiden voyage. End of story. Now, you tell the story of that format, problem is people find out they don't already know ships sank, 1,500 people drowned. And when that is known, the backlash on the story, absolutely catastrophic. And this, in fact, is one of the most common leadership mistakes in using storytelling is to tell a titanic story, tell a story that omits some crucial detail which, when it becomes known, has a catastrophic effect on the leader and the story. So first element, true story, authentically true story. Secondly, it's a story that's positive in tone. You get attention with negative stories, but in order to inspire people, Hollywood's right, it has to have a happy ending. And the reasons for this come out of neuroscience. The last couple of hundred years, a whole lot of attention paid to the human brain, the cortex, but even more attention now being paid to the mammal brain, which is just under the human brain, the limbic system, and below that, the reptile brain. And these mammal reptile brains are not very smart, but they are very quick. And they're useful for some things. You're driving along the highway, something comes in front of you, and these little guys will wake you up and say, wake up, something bad is happening. They wake up, so they survive. So they've been useful for some things, but in storytelling they have a drawback, because when you're telling a negative story, say about a firm who went bankrupt because they did not implement knowledge management, and those little gadgets are into action, wake up, something bad is happening. And the human brain can intervene and say, now calm down, reptile brain, we may actually learn something from this instructive experience. And the human brain will generally win that debate, but does the person rush out into action? No. They're recovering from another encounter with the reptile brain. But if on the other hand, you tell a positive story about how you've got the answer and solved the problem and moved into the future, then what seems to be happening is the limbic system is providing what's called an endogenous opiate reward to the cortex. It basically puts the brain on drugs, injects a substance called dopamine into parts of the brain, and creates a mild sense of euphoria, so warm and floaty feeling. One cool feeling we have after we've just seen a great movie. Wow, I feel terrific. Change the organization? No problem. Let's do it. That'd be very much. So it's a true story. It has a positive tone, and it is told in a very strange way. It's told in a minimalist fashion. These are not like entertainment stories about the sights and the smells and the sounds and what it looks like. No, these are very stripped down, streamlined stories. You think about that Zambia story about a health worker in Zambia. Was it a nurse or a doctor? Was it wet? Was it cold? Didn't tell you anything. I didn't want you stranded in Zambia. I wanted to stay right here to be thinking about knowledge. And the reason I do that, tell the story in a strange way, is that, in fact, there are two listeners. You look out at an audience, look like I'm listening to a person. No, there's two. There's the listener you see, and there's also the little voice in the head. And we all know what the little voice in the head is, but if you are sitting there and asking yourself, I wonder what Steve means by the little voice in the head. That's the little voice I mean. The little voice that you hear all day, every day of your life, hugely important. And it may be drowning out everything I'm saying. I'm talking about Sandra, and the little voice is saying, I should never have come to this session this afternoon. All these things that are maybe drowning out everything I'm saying. And conventional communication says, well, just ignore that, hope for the best, but you can do better than that. You can give the little voice something to do. And the task that you assign the little voice in the head is to tell a new story. And in fact, it's this new story that drives the listener to action. I'm telling you about Zambia, but you've got to work in Zambia, but you have some knowledge, and you're thinking, well, I could be sharing my knowledge. Plus, I have to have a website, I have to get resources, I have to get more people involved. Why don't I do it? I just had a great idea. And once it becomes the listener's idea, that's when you're off to the races. If it's my idea only, nothing much happens. But if it becomes the listener's idea, that's when they become champions of the idea. So it's a true story, positive in tone, minimalist in form, and fourthly, and very importantly, it is a story that contrasts the before situation, before the idea was implemented, and the situation after the idea is implemented. So it's in a big, complex idea, you can in fact get lost in the story and miss the point of the story. So you tell the story of the way things are before the story, before the change idea happens, and you tell the story of change idea after changes happen, and it's weaving those two together that you can communicate a very big, complex idea. I've been involved in such an idea the last year or two, showing how big organizations, big, horrible bureaucracies, can be turned into wonderful organizations where it's fun to work, where they delight their customer, and where they also are very good to the organization, they're very efficient, and they make a lot of money. How can you do all of those three things at once? I was challenged to communicate this in less than 60 seconds. So here's how to use a story to communicate a very complex idea in less than 60 seconds.
In the world of 2011, there are only two kinds of organizations, those that delight their customers and those that don't. In those that delight their customers, managers are enablers of self-organizing teams and continuous innovation. In the other firms, managers are controllers of individuals doing more of the same. In firms that delight their customers, employees are fully engaged in creating great customer outcomes. In the other firms, work is a dreary grind to produce merely average outputs. The firms that delight their customers are hugely profitable, while the other firms struggle just to stay in place. Firms that delight their customers are putting the other firms out of business. You know why this is happening, and we have the radical management principles that drive it.